My name is Meredith Southard, and I'm speaking today with Nicole Nikki Nesda. It is Friday, February 7th, I believe, 2020. And we are here today talking with Nikki about her experiences growing up in Colonial Hills and her other experiences with Worthington. So I guess I'll begin by asking, what would you most want listeners to know about the Colonial Hills of your childhood?
Well, I've thought about this, and I think the thing that I feel the most when I think back was the sense of independence and agency that we had, because it was a safe neighborhood, and we lived on our bikes, and we could ride anywhere. Our parents, you know, trusted us to get on the bike, and we lived on Meadoway Park, so it was pretty far north, and we would, you know, we could go up to Colonial Market, otherwise known as the Little White, anytime we wanted to, drive around the neighbor or ride around the neighborhood. And even when we were young on our street, and my sister was talking about this yesterday, we could go up and down people's driveways on our bikes. And so she said we used to call them the hills. So we thought we were, you know, mountain biking. But the neighbors, you know, they knew who everybody was. They didn't care. It was a place for the children, as much as for the, you know, the adults and the families. But I remember that sense of agency that I kind of, you know, had some self-direction in my daytime life.
Mm-hmm. You were sort of able to pick and choose where you went and what you did, and there was no one looming over you telling you what to do.
No, and no, it's, you can only go two blocks, or no, it's not safe. And as we got a little older, first we could ride to Colonial Market, then we could ride to Nicholas Drugs at Sharon Square. And then when I was really old, we could ride our bikes up to Graceland, and that was kind of a big deal.
Yeah, that's far away.
But yeah. But that, I mean, it's a sense of, you know, of, like I said, agency, or learning to be responsible for your own life and learning to have some choices and, you know, not having helicopter parents, because I don't think anybody felt the need to be a helicopter parent in that way. And it isn't that there weren't things to be careful of. You know, there were rumors about somebody in this woods and don't go in that woods, and I wasn't allowed to sled on Devil's Hill because the story was somebody gotten killed there, which I think was not the story other people from Colonial Hills know, but that's what I was told. You know, so there was a Peeping Tom once. You know, so it was a normal kind of thing, but it also was a place that kids just, you know, had autonomy. And we knew each other, and like I said, all the parents knew us, and we knew, and we called our neighbors' parents by their first names, which some people I suppose would think was kind of impolite, but for us it was, you know, a trust, and we knew everybody, and we had relationships with everybody.
And I know that your family moved from Colonial Hills to Worthington Estates. How old were you when you made that move?
I was in middle school, okay. I think 8th grade.
Okay.
Yeah, I had to be in 8th grade.
And I know you had, how many siblings did you have?
I have a sister who's 13 months younger than me, which is an important part of my story, and my brother Eric, who's 5 years younger, 6th grade younger.
So you're the oldest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What's the story with your sister?
Well, she was 13 months younger than me. She is. And she was 6 inches taller and dark hair, dark eyes. And but my mom raised us pretty much like twins. And so she was my best friend, and everything we did together. And when I was old enough to, say, have First Communion, Mom would convince the priest that Terry was capable of doing that too, so we would do it together. And when I started ballet lessons, we did that together. I just got a picture of my Bluebird troupe. A friend sent it to me from, like, 5th grade. And she was in it, even though she wasn't in my class.
Oh, wow.
So we were really raised very much like twins, except that we looked so very different. And then when we got to high school, and we were best friends in high school, there were especially boys who would say things like, "You can't be sisters because you get along too well." And we'd say, "Well, we can both spell our last name, so they're sisters."
Yeah, that sounds really beneficial to both of you, mm-hmm. because she had a mentor, and then you had a friend. And
or the other way around.
So, yeah.
I mean, because she was bigger than me, a lot of people thought she was the older sister.
Older.
So I always had this chip on my shoulder about not being able to be the big sister.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I was still an infant when she was born, so I'm not sure I had a lot of ever sense of being just me in the world.
That's great.
Maybe that's also why I felt some autonomy, because when my mom let us out the door, there was always two of us.
Where did you attend school, and what do you remember of it?
I went to the Ohio State University School, which was one of the most important influences on my whole life, on who I am and how I relate to people. And it was a place, founded on progressive education theories, John Dewey. It was experimental, it was creativity, it was individualized, it was project-based learning. It was democratic learning. So sometimes the class might decide what the class study was going to be instead of the teacher making the curriculum. So they taught process rather than very specific content. And it was very diversified. We had, you know, socioeconomically diversified, racially diversified. We had Down syndrome kids in the 50s in our school integrated with everybody else. When that was the time in history when people were saying, just put them in an institution. Mm-hmm. You know, you mother can't handle this. And fathers would leave the family because they didn't want to be known for being the parent of a handicapped child. And yet these kids were welcomed in. And so that was really, really wonderful. I believe there's a couple reasons I believe we went there. The personal reason my mom just told me is that she had these two kids that were almost twins and my brother, and my dad had just been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and she needed a break, and university school had a summer school kindergarten class, and she could get rid of me for a while every day. So that was part of us going there, and it was a really good match. But the other thing she's told me for years is that there were no kindergartens in Worthington schools then. So this was 1957. And she and a woman named Nancy Weary, who had a handicapped son, and a couple other women, much like your story about the sidewalks, got together and lobbied the superintendent, Harold McCord, about kindergartens. And he said to her, and I quote my mother, Mary, there will never be kindergartens in Worthington. So I believe that one reason we went to university school is they had this kindergarten program, which I'd already experienced, and it was really good. That's so we did not go to Worthington schools until Ohio State School, University School closed.
Okay.
So I started in ninth grade at the Worthington High School.
Was that kind of a culture shock?
Absolutely.
Going into a regular...
It was a culture shock, both because it was so different and also because we were very aware that we had this other way of learning and this kind of respect from the adults that was different from what happens in public school. And so I was very conscious of how is this going to be different and what do I have to do to adapt, and I wouldn't have used the word achieve, but, you know, be successful at this.
Yeah.
And socially it was a terrible culture shock because all my university school pictures, my glasses are like this, and we didn't have hairdos, you know, and we didn't care what we looked like.
Yeah.
And then I walk into high school and everybody's hair, if you wanted to be popular, your hair had to flip perfectly. And I had one hair that would never flip perfectly. And you had to have popular friends, and they would meet in the locker room in the morning and tease up each other's hair and spray it and get it all right. And I didn't have those friends, so that was my perception when I walked into school. But, you know, it was very cliquish, and it was the kids who had grown up throughout Worthington School seemed to have a leg up on everybody else, and there were, you know, clear groups of people that some people didn't want to hang out with, which really bugged me. And
yeah, I mean, it sounds from the way you described university school, just coming to Worthington would have been, the population here seems so much more homogenous, I guess, than the diversity of just, you know, people and, you know.
Yeah, and we took that pretty normal, to have this rather diverse population.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that's on your list of questions that I've thought a lot about has to do with certain regulations in Colonial Hills and other parts of Worthington that started in the 50s, I believe, that selected out people of color in particular. I'm not sure that I was aware that there aren't any black people in Colonial Hills, but I was certainly aware that there were all these kinds of people in the school I had come from. And then when I was in high school, my very best friend, and her father's name was Seth Washburn, and they lived in Medica States, but he was instrumental in working politically to get housing in Worthington Estates and places like that available to black families. And later on, my friend Becky said that they would have bricks thrown through their windows, and his children were threatened for trying to, you know, move black families into the, you know, newer, better housing in Worthington.
Yeah.
So, I did have that kind of awareness.
Mm-hmm.
We had in high school, there were twins, tall twin guys that were African-American who played basketball. They were kind of basketball stars. And there was a girl, I think in my sister's class, who was dating them. And the rumors were that her dad made her break up, dating one of them. Her dad made her break up with him,
yeah,
you know, because of the racial differences and that kind of thing. So that's something I've always been aware of.
Mm-hmm.
It's also something that now currently bothers me about Worthington. And if you go to some of the schools like Wilson Hill, it's extremely diverse. And yet, if we have the old Worthington Association dinner on High Street, you might see one or two black faces there.
Mm-hmm.
The Historical Society, we really don't talk about the black history. We don't have, you know, an integrated population of people volunteering there and talking about the history of Worthington. Even though there were at least two black families that lived at the OJ House, and one of them had 10 kids.
I didn't know that.
Yes. It was a rental property, and there were two African-American families that lived there. And one had 10 children, so if you look at it statistically, there may have been more black people living in the OJ House than white people over history, you know? So, yes, I am aware and concerned about diversity in Worthington.
Are you aware of, you know, any move to change that, or is that just...
Okay. When we had candidate night.
Uh-huh.
For this last election, that question was raised about diversity.
Yeah.
And almost all the candidates said, well, diversity is really good and we should have it.
Yeah.
Nobody said, let's start a task force. Let's have a sharing community event. Nobody said, let's bring I believe there's Somali immigrants that are at Wilson Hill. Let's bring them in to talk about their experiences. Let's, you know, bring in the children of the old Worthington black families who've been there for many more generations than most people here. Let's have them come in. Let's do a multicultural event to actually break the barriers.
Yeah.
Help people know each other. You know, nobody said that. Nobody had an answer, just that diversity's good.
Yeah.
And we should have it. And somebody talked about age diversity.
Mm.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm not very active trying to solve this problem, but I also haven't found a venue or a way in to kind of bring the communities together either.
I mean, it just sounds like a very large and longstanding problem, and I'm sure it's like that other places as well.
It may have. I'm not sure. But it may have started in the 50s and 60s,
yeah,
when these housing restrictions were put into place.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But I know there are old Worthington families that are African-American. I know Harry Todd, for instance, was an important member of the Worthington Savings Bank, I think it was, or Park Federal Bank, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, he's a guy that you see him in the grocery store and you're excited to see him. So, you know, there were families that were well-known and a part of the community.
Yeah.
And that may have changed, or maybe not. I don't know.
A question that's sort of in a similar vein, just in terms of your experience, you know, growing up and being aware of these larger issues in Worthington. Did the Vietnam War, how did that affect you and your friends? Or what were you aware of?
Yeah,
when you were growing up?
I think that's a really important question. My awareness of the Vietnam War started the day that my dad was sitting in Colonial Hills, you know, we have a little living room. We didn't have family room. So he's sitting in the living room. We're walking between him and the TV. And I remember the Kennedy assassination that way. But I also remember one day walking between him and the TV, and he had a terrible look on his face. And I said, "Daddy, what's wrong?" And he said, "I think we're about to go into a war." I don't think that was the Cuban Missile Crisis. It could have been. I think, but that was, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin or whatever started the Vietnam War. So I had that little bit of awareness at university school in 7th grade or 8th grade. We each did independent studies on different, what's that part of the world called? They were Indo-Chinese countries then. And yeah. I did one on Cambodia and Prince Sihanouk, and I don't remember anything about him. But then I came to Worthington High School in 9th grade, and I don't remember any talk about it at all. Mm-hmm. Except that Spike Bonnell, I'm still back on the other topic. Spike Bonnell had been killed in a helicopter crash, and we had a big assembly in the gym honoring him. Mm.
Was he in your class?
No, he was several years ahead of me.
Okay.
So I didn't know him.
Yeah.
But somebody died in Vietnam, you know. So we had that. And it may have been the time when his dad was on the school board.
Oh.
Because sometime when I was in high school, I believe Dr. Bonnell was on the school board.
Yeah, that name is very familiar. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, well, the Bonnells are a really multi-generational family in Worthington. They were pretty important. So there was that. And then I remember senior year in government class, we had current event quizzes. I don't remember any questions about the Vietnam War on the current event quizzes. Maybe they were the questions I couldn't answer. I didn't do very well on those quizzes. But we didn't have, like, discussions. I didn't know all this protest was going on. People laugh about, did I go to Woodstock? We didn't know Woodstock was going on. And one of the examples I used was senior year in high school, we'd go to football games in white, in plaid wool shorts and high knee socks, kind of dressed up for the football games, very conservative, you can imagine, tight, you know, Bermuda shorts and knee socks and loafers. And I go to college. I went to Ohio Wesleyan, which was one-third population was from the East Coast, so it was much more liberal, socially and politically liberal, than what I was used to here. And I remember buying my first pair of flared pants, right? And I didn't know the music that, you know, other kids were listening to and all that kind of stuff. So it was very much a culture shock.
Yeah.
Right away, knew about Vietnam War and protest, and people would walk by the TV on our way to dinner, and people would stop to see if they recognized the classmates that were at the March on Washington. And,
oh, wow. Wow.
You know, that kind of thing. And this doesn't have to do with Worthington, but I remember the first draft. And I was at a fraternity house on a date, and all these, I guess you'd call it a date, the night of the draft, it wasn't really a date, but all these senior guys and their girlfriends were sitting there waiting for their number to come up to decide what their futures were. Do we get married? Do we not get married? Do I go to graduate school? Do I go to war? You know, if you can imagine, your whole life is like one moment when their number comes up, when your birthday comes up.
Just pure chance.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Right. And determined everything. And so, you know, there was that another culture shock in my life from the pretty sheltered, more or less behaviorally conservative Worthington and the kind of loves, what is it? Drug, sex, and rock and roll of going to college. I graduated in 1969, and that was a pivotal year.
Yeah.
Because after that, Worthington High School was involved in the war protests and these kind of things. But my year, it wasn't. Hmm. And that spring in college then was the summer that the spring that Kent State happened.
Hmm.
So lots of things changed that year. But my year at Worthington High School was like the last year of the old way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just, as a quick aside, it's interesting because we've been adding Worthington High School yearbooks to our Worthington mm-hmm. Memory website, mm-hmm. and the 70s seem like it was a sea change
yes,
from what you were
yes,
talking
exactly.
about your experience.
Exactly. So here's this Worthington High School story. So senior year, Every year from the time I was in seventh grade, we'd take our same wool skirts from last year and take our hems up 2 inches. So senior year, I was in an enriched English class. I won't say the teacher's name, but he was very, very popular. He was a very good teacher. But we were having a conversation about the dress code and how we didn't think they should have a dress code. Of course, university school never had a dress code. So, you know, to me that was ridiculous anyway. But so the teacher was saying, well, I understand what you're saying, but the community is not ready for us to get rid of the dress code, which, of course, they did the next year. But anyway. And so the dress code was that our skirts couldn't be any more than, I think it was 3 inches above our knees. And I raised my hand and I said, but I just bought this skirt. And I'm short. And this is as long as it came. I can't even buy something that meets the dress code. He had me stand on a chair in front of the class with lots of boys in the class. My phone's going off, or somebody's phone's going off. Had me stand on a chair, and he took a ruler and actually put it against my leg, which means he touched my leg, and measured, and it was like 5 inches above my knee or something. He goes, oh, that's 3 inches. You're okay.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was perfectly fine. That's
like
the way it was.
A normal thing to do. Wow.
Yeah. At the time, I was mad that he lied, and I was mad that, you know, my argument wasn't being honored.
Yeah.
But I never thought of anything about there's a man teacher touching touching my thigh.
Wow. Well, and it's so funny that you mentioned the dress code, because we've seen some newsletter, the Chronicle student newsletter, that I guess they published at the time. Someone donated a bunch to us, and the dress code was just like, that was all.
Oh, they were terrified. The adults were boys' hair couldn't. You know, this was 2 or 3, 4 years after the Beatles, you know, came to America, but boys' hair wasn't allowed to touch their collars. And they had to wear socks. It was like cool to wear loafers without socks. They had to wear socks. Girls couldn't wear pants. We could not wear pants to school. So two memories about that are, first of all, that we'd wear these short skirts. We didn't have pantyhose yet. We had garters and, you know, individual hose. And so I would sit, like in geometry class, I remember, in my orange skirt, the whole time holding my skirt down so it would cover my garters when I was sitting in the chair. And then the welts in the back of our legs.
Oh, that's so uncomfortable.
Right? Yeah. But, you know, that's the way it was. And girdles. We wore girdles. We wore girdles because I guess that's, you know, left over from the 50s. And the only thing I can imagine is they didn't want our, you know, rear ends shaking. And but you know, we wore these Empire waist dresses that looked like maternity dresses. So, but yeah, it was pretty old fashioned that way.
Yeah.
So there's that memory, and the other memory is walking home from school, because we weren't allowed to drive to school. Not that my family could afford an extra car, but and my legs were like red. And you know, when it get really cold, you get real itchy. I mean, it was terrible. And I walked from Worthington High School to Worthington Estates, or not even Worthing Way. So, you know, it wasn't that long of a walk, but because we weren't allowed to wear pants. Mm-hmm. Boys couldn't wear jeans, and they were very strict about that. And they would send kids down to the office and cut their hair, or send girls home to put on longer skirts. I mean, I guess. That's my memory.
And then it's just like you missed it by just a few years.
Yeah,
because before
a year.
Long, yeah, yeah. You've already mentioned many ways that your childhood was different than other children who were growing up at the time. I don't know if you care to talk about what it was like growing up with your father and his disability and just how that affected your family and your childhood.
Absolutely, because it's a very important part of who I am and who our family is. But the thing that came to mind first when you said that, which is interesting, is that my mother worked. My mother had a college degree. She didn't work. And then when my brother was born, the same time as my brother was born, my dad got his diagnosis, like when my mom was in the hospital. Of course, then you were in the hospital for a week when you had a baby anyway. And so my dad worked for a couple of years and then was no longer capable of, you know, doing the work on the job. And so my mom went back and taught preschool. And had my brother in preschool with her, because, like, there's not childcare, right? And then Oh, this is a great story. So this one summer, and I'm trying to think, she was teaching preschool and Eric was 3, so I was probably about 8. My dad had lost his job. He had just gotten a new job and he couldn't do it. And he'd lost his job, and we had gone to visit my grandmother in Western New York. And my parents believed that when we came back home, we were going to have to go on public assistance, on welfare, because I imagine preschool teachers made like $1 a year or something back then, because they didn't make much the year I was teaching preschool. And my mom she had early on, right out of college, done some teaching at the Columbus Academy. Anyway, we're in this little podunk town in New York that you can't find on a map hardly. And she gets a phone call from Columbus School for Girls saying, we know somebody who knows somebody who knows you, and said you might be interested in finding work, and would you like to work at Columbus School for Girls? And it was like the miracle. Mm-hmm. It was like the family miracle, you know. And so she began teaching, which led her to graduate school, which led her to a PhD, which led her to an administrative job at Ohio State.
Oh, wow.
And she says that's because she had to. You know, nowadays she would have followed her talents, but then, well, she said that she used to write notes to my dad, put in his lunchbox or something, and sign him wifey. So, you know, that was the mentality with which she entered adulthood, right? So there was that she worked. And she would say to me, you need to go to college and you need to get a career, because you never know if you might have to be responsible for yourself, take care of yourself. So there was that influence, definitely. The thing about my dad was, we learned that your value as a human being didn't have to do with your job, your job title, your income, your achievement. There was something innately important about a human being. And my dad was a great guy, and he was funny. And we got to know him in a way other kids didn't get to know their dads, because their dads were at work all the time. And their dads, I take care of you because I bring lots of money home to your mother to run the house, you know. But my dad was home. Whenever I came home, he was home. And so we learned that all people are important. And I don't want to say they weren't their handicap, because he kind of was. But you don't dismiss people, or you don't move them out. You love them. Mm-hmm. And you find out what's lovable about them, and they love you, and that's so much more important than, you know, what his job might have been if he hadn't have been sick.
Yeah.
So there was that. And then the other part of it was, I was never embarrassed to bring people home. My brother tells stories of being embarrassed, and stories of my dad falling and nobody helping him get up and that kind of thing. I don't have memories like that. I remember bringing dates home and not being embarrassed that my dad was in a wheelchair. It was just, my mom always said she wanted us to have as normal a life as possible, so I thought I had a normal life until I grew up and looked back and realized there was a lot of dysfunction. There were a lot of family roles that we took on because of that, and my dad was sort of the center focus of the family, which, again, you know, in Colonial Hills then, my mom didn't have to be entertaining us all the time. My mom didn't have to be driving me places all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, she could be at work, or she could be, you know, with dad, and we could be okay.
Yeah, I'm really struck by just the compassion that's been in your family because of all the hardships that you've faced, and just trying to imagine what it must have been like, especially in that era, for a woman to run a household, have a job, have 3 children. You know,
kind of crazy.
That's very unique, I would think.
And I have acquaintances, kids that I grew up with, who say that your mother was the only one I knew that worked, and she had left such a great impression.
Yeah.
Also, you know, the strong woman thing. you know, my mom ran the family and brought home the bacon and all that stuff in the song, which, so I just grew up naturally feeling like I should be able to say what I want and have a job and be hired. And so there were some things about being a woman that got me, that I felt like I got in trouble for trying to be too, just a person instead of a woman, you know, and some naivete about that with the university school experience, where we were encouraged to discuss. We didn't have to raise our hands to speak in a discussion, you know, that kind of thing. And then my mom being so empowered in many ways, I kind of walked into the world just thinking, I can say what I believe, and I can stick up for kids, and, you know, it didn't always go that well. And I remember, like, when the first year I applied for a teaching job in Worthington, and that's when your dad was, he wasn't personnel director, he was assistant superintendent, mm-hmm. something else.
Yeah.
And my husband now, John, his brother was teaching art, and his brother said to John, I don't remember this, but his brother said to him, because he was dating John then, our head art teacher doesn't want to hire a woman because they just get married and have kids and quit, which I did. But still, you know, that was said to me clearly. There was this place I had to find, and it took 60 years to find this place between being a person and an empowered woman, or wanting to be an empowered woman, and being this person that people don't want to hear from sometimes.
It was kind of like a double-edged sword for mm-hmm. you, because you had this strength, but then the world just wouldn't let you show it. Yeah,
and I didn't understand that. Probably from going through university school, where we were encouraged to think things through and have our opinions and share our opinions, and ideas were ideas, they weren't personal. So if we disagreed, a good thing for this time in our history, but if we disagreed, we didn't disagree with you as a person. It was just throwing ideas around. And this belief that it's that way that we come to the best idea or a compromise idea or the truth, you know, and the rest of the world doesn't work that way. So, and another thing about teaching is that lots of attempts have been made to reform teaching. And most of the reforms that have been suggested, at least when I was in the profession, were reforms that were much like what happened at university school. And none of them took root. And I think the reason they didn't take root is because rarely was there somebody in the public schools had ever experienced any other way of teaching or learning. And I had. So I could see the value of it, and yet, you know, I wasn't the person to implement this. So there was also this people teach the way they lived, the way they learned kind of thing going on. And I had wanted to integrate this humanity in from university school. But you also asked about the compassion and the empathy and the family. A lot of that came from my dad being sick, but a lot of that came from generations past. Both sides of my family were immigrant families, which is another thing that's really important to me and another way I feel different. Where I didn't grow up, I grew up with the English speaker and not in abject poverty. My grandparents, I could hardly understand my grandfather when I got to be 15. I'm the oldest cousin, and I could understand what he was saying. I felt like part of the, you know, older part of the family now. A lot of poverty, a lot of cultural ignorance. But my father would say, and I always remember this, he'd say, oh, my mother gave away something I wanted. She said she always gave away stuff to the poor. I never know how she found somebody poorer than us, but she gave it away to the poor. And so that was kind of who my dad was. You know, he had this tremendous belief in equality and socioeconomic equality and working people and unions and, you know, all those kind of things that help people get to a functional, socioeconomically functional level. So I got that from him.
Where is your family, where did they immigrate from, just out of curiosity?
Oh, this is great. My mom's family were Italian, Southern Italian and Sicilian. So my grandfather, who literally was my size, when I was in college, I was 5'2" and 105 pounds. My grandfather was 5'2" and 105 pounds because my mom had a tailored suit made for him. That's how I knew that. He came from Sicily. So there's a lot of that in the family. There's a lot of that, you know, family loyalty and express your emotions at whatever decibel level you want. And if they're not listening to you, talk louder. But, you know, Carfagna's meats and homemade wine and little funny cigars and the compadres coming over Sunday after dinner and the men sitting there drinking and talking. Names like Carmel Pandolfo, and, you know, there's that in my background. But my dad's side of the family's from Slovenia. And when I was a kid, nobody knew where Slovenia was, but it was part of Yugoslavia then. And what I've come to learn is that my grandparents immigrated. They lived three houses from the railroad tracks in this little town in New York. And when other Slovenians immigrated to the United States, they would come and stay in my grandparents' house, and they would help them learn the language and get work and this kind of thing. And then they could, you know, integrate into society a little bit. I've also come to learn that my grandmother lost three children. She, during the flu epidemic of 1918, I guess the town was pretty decimated. She lost a child and she lost an infant and two siblings who were children, 2 days apart during the flu epidemic. She was caring for everybody and she didn't get sick. My aunt died when she was in her 50s. My dad had MS. My grandfather died in his early 60s. And then a few years ago, I was doing Ancestry and was going through some stuff online and found a death certificate for her first child that I never knew she had. So I had this uncle I'd never heard of who died at 6 months in Youngstown when my grandfather was working in the steel mills. And he died of pneumonia. So I think about, you know, the air quality, and they may not have had heat in the house because this was 19-teens sometime. So I feel like there's this family. They talk about generational trauma and epigenetics and almost a cosmic, spiritual kind of theme that runs through our family. Mm-hmm. And then my grandmother's family, her father worked for the railroad and had a leg cut off in a train accident. And so she had to drop out of school and go to work to help support the family. And yes, that's my family history, but it's a lot of people's family history from if you go back that many generations. Mm-hmm. But it is something that I think about that's part of me and my life and has helped me also to think if my grandmother had survived this, you know, maybe she's there helping me survive what I've had to survive. So that's there. But very different from the Worthington family I knew. I hope she never sees this. Who, when Gary was dying from cancer and he was still coaching, I went to a track meet with him because I didn't want him to go alone. I used to go with him a long time before I had kids, but that got to be too much. But anyway, I went to this track meet with him, and it was when cell phones were new. And this woman said to me, "Oh, my God, I had to buy a cell phone because something happened." I said, "Well, what happened?" And she said, "Well, I went out to lunch with a friend and I didn't get home in time to take my son to soccer practice and he had to call somebody else to get a ride." You know, so I had this perception that, you know, a lot of the people in my neighborhood and a lot of the people at my school had very different, easy lives and a lot more money than we did, so. Yeah, that's my prejudice. It's against rich people with easy lives.
Would you want to talk more about, you know, as we were reading, there was, you won the Everyday Heroes Award for your work volunteering at the Dowd Educational Center, mm-hmm. the Homeless Families Foundation, and, you know, we read about your husband, Gary Smith, renowned teacher, track coach, your son, Tony Smith, who died in 2008, and who was also a teacher.
Fabulous teacher.
Yeah. I mean, just this thread of tragedy that has run through your family, but yet you all have really funneled it into this very compassionate work. Do you care to talk about, you know, how you've done that, or...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of who I am.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know where to start.
Give
me a specific question.
Big,
we can start with the Down Center.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to start with Tony in the Down Center. So my son Tony was a very unique, extremely caring, very egalitarian, and highly creative. Did I say that? Highly creative person who thought differently and learned differently and really struggled in, especially by high school, but struggled in Worthington schools because people didn't, they didn't, he had a learning disability that wasn't identified till he was in his 20s because I finally got him tested. Because by that time I had a PhD in education, so I knew we should get him tested, right? But the schools just thought he was lazy, the typical things, lazy, disorganized, didn't care, irreverent, oppositional, you know, all those things. So he really, really struggled. And he always cared about other people very much. In fact, he's the one that taught me to be even more accepting and more inclusive, because I thought, you know, I had the typical white person philosophies about equality. But then he said to me one time, "Mom, what would it really be like if you really accepted everybody as equal?" That really opened my mind. So anyway, he one Christmas said he didn't want a present. He wanted me to donate to something. And my brother Eric had done something with the Teresa Dowd School for Homeless Kids years and years and years before, so I knew about this place a little bit. So I went down and talked to some people, and I made like a $100 donation to the Dowd School that year. And I gave it to Tony for Christmas. You know, and the girls, you get clues, and you do this and that, and everybody gets a book. And he opened this present that said, "I made this donation." And he got tears in his eyes, and he looked at me, and he said, "Mom, you get it." So, yeah, that had an effect on me. So when he died in 2008, he graduated from high school in 97. Okay. So when he died, you know, like 10 years later, and I wanted to do something. I called them, and that's why I volunteered there. I don't know. Was it a way to connect with Tony? Was it a way to live out his potential? Was it something to do? And I knew that. I don't know. But I had done a program that I initiated in Worthington, at Worthington Kilbourne, which was called Creative Mondays, or sometimes Creative Thursdays. And it was just an after-school art therapy-like program. So kids would come in, and they would pick a theme, and they would do art on that theme, and we'd talk about it. It was a way for them to deal with whatever they wanted that was going on in their lives, and get some adult who listened, and an adult who, some supervision or some interventions or just some, you know, empathy. And I piloted a program one semester doing that with the kids in in-school suspension. So we could kind of get to the underlying causes of why they screw up all the time in school, and maybe find out, maybe teachers needed better understanding, maybe they needed a therapist, maybe one kid I ended up calling Children's Services and she was removed from her home, and one kid was back-talking teachers because he'd come from Columbus schools. He was a Hispanic kid, and that's just the way kids acted in Columbus, and now I'm in Worthington, and why do I keep getting in trouble, you know, that kind of thing. So when I retired, I wrote up a proposal to do this kind of a thing with kids at the Dowd Center. The Dowd Center is an after-school program originally for homeless and previously homeless kids, and now it's more generally low socioeconomic kids in west side of Columbus, Grub Street, right by... If you go down 315 South and you pass this big building with this big mural about Franklinton...
Yeah, I think I've seen. Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. That's the building.
Okay.
So I just started this because I wanted to do it, because it needs to be done, and because I think the kids need to be listened to. There's so much bad stuff going down in these kids' lives that they accept as normal. Okay, that's my life. You know, they accept it as normal, and they get in trouble for their behaviors that are their coping skills or their modeling after what they've grown up with, and nobody listens to know what's going on.
Yeah.
They do at the Doubt Center. They care, but still, it's a lot of academic-based stuff. But what I hear about the public schools, these kids, there's so much bullying and so much assault to their self-esteem and their sense of worth, and these kids grow up in situations where they probably feel no sense of worth to begin with. So to bring the circle back around, they're worthy because they're human beings, not because of what they are or aren't achieving, not because of the language they use or because they hit a kid or they don't hit another kid, not because if their father's in jail or not in jail. They're just fabulous little kids.
Yeah.
So I only do it like a couple hours a week, and I don't want to make a big deal out of it because it's not like I've walked in there and taken over the school and done this great thing. I just bring in some art supplies and listen for a couple hours.
Yeah. I mean, but I, just thinking back to my own childhood, like sometimes all it took was that one adult,
yeah.
You know, to really reach out and...
Well, there's statistics that I read in graduate school are that one adult can compensate for seven bad relationships with adults, like in the school. Seven bad teachers can be balanced out by one really caring teacher. That's statistics. I don't know if it's true or not. But I also sometimes think, how would my life have been different if one of the guidance counselors, and like my mom was in school and everybody knew about my life and they all idolized my mom and everything. How would my life have been different if one adult had said to me, what's really going on in your home? How do you really feel about this? Mm-hmm. Or, you matter. It's not just about your dad, you know. Who are you in this family, and who are you in this world, and, you know, how's it going for you? Mm-hmm. Things might have been different.
Mm-hmm.
Or I might have covered it up and said it's normal. I don't know, but I keep thinking if somebody had gotten underneath the surface and asked, how might things have been different?
I guess, is there anything else that we've covered so much territory?
I know.
I'm trying to think if I'm forgetting any questions.
I'm so honored that you're asking me to talk about these things.
Yeah.
I have a funny story.
Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
So when we lived in Colonial Hills at Sharon Square Shopping Center was Gable's Dairy, which was also a big, important part of the extended community. But they had a Gable Dairy's ice cream store, and ice cream cones were 5 cents. And they opened up the first Baskin-Robbins right across whatever that street is, Chase or something. One time, and we loved it. Oh, it was so good. And my dad said, why would anybody go over there to Baskin-Robbins and spend 15 cents on an ice cream cone when you can buy one at Gable's for 5 cents? So, yeah, I remember that.
It seemed like we interviewed John. He mentioned, was it Isley's Dairy?
Yeah, Isley's was at Graceland.
Okay, Graceland.
So that was real special.
Okay.
And you know how they always put, like, triple scoops on? Well, Isley's, you could get one scoop, or you could get, they were called skyscrapers, you could get a pointy, or you could get a really big pointy one. So there were three sizes, and it was Isley's. Yeah, that was really a big deal to go there. That was special. But we did our, like, grocery shopping at Graceland because there was a Big Bear and a Kroger's and an Albers. And my mom would collect stamps, you know about these? They would give you, instead of coupons, they would give you stamps. And then my mom and the kids, and then we'd sit there and lick them and put them in these books. And when so many books were full, you could go buy a set of dishes or a new vacuum cleaner or something with your savings stamps. So we did that. And we bought all our records. There was a record store. Or there was Woolco, which was, you know, the Walmart of the time. And so, you know, whenever the new Beatles record came out or the new Simon, no, it was just before Simon and Garfunkel, Peter and Gordon, I just met him and I couldn't remember his name. Peter and Gordon, but Natalie's.
Oh, my gosh.
Or Chad and Jeremy. We just saw Jeremy up at at Natalie's. Whenever those records would come out, you know, my sister and I go to Woolco and get and buy the latest 45, and you know, so it was kind of a youth oriented community.
Yeah.
And the swimming pool. Oh, the swimming pool was everything. And we had dances on the tennis courts on summer nights. There were a lot of people complained there wasn't anything for teens to do, but I just thought there was so much to do. There were always boys. There were always boys and tennis. We took my sister and I. She was going into seventh grade, and I was going into ninth grade, integrating into public school, right? And we took tennis lessons that summer for these two guys that had just graduated from high school, so they were older men, you know, and gorgeous, and they had been state champion tennis players, and that was one of the highlights, was taking tennis lessons with them. So, yeah, that, to me, there was a lot of stuff to do.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for talking to us today. You have such an interesting story.
Thank you.
And really interesting perspective.
Really?
In Worthington, yeah.
Well, you know, you live a life like mine, and you either succumb to it or you start figuring a lot of things out,
yeah.
Right? And so that's, I guess, what I've done. And that's partly why I studied creativity, why my doctorate's in creativity, because that was a way into understanding.
Yeah.
So thanks. Yeah. Thanks a lot for having me. And when you wrote me yesterday, I was so honored for you to look at me as a person I am. That was nice. Thank you.
You're welcome.